At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Grab your pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for inciting a riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather, and we're going to march, and we're going to blow its f***ing house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing, dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. Today, episode 152, I am so excited to welcome back one of my favorite guests, sort of another repeat guest that we've had in the last year. Some of you guys out there are just so freaking creative, man. You're churning out this amazing body of work in this short amount of time, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I feel so very, very unaccomplished in life. Today we are inciting a Weaving Fate riot because I am welcoming back Aiden Wachter to talk about his new book, Weaving Fate: Hypersigils, Changing the Past and Telling True Lies. Since we last spoke to Aiden, he has kind of gone on to not create a genre of his own, but to sort of kind of spearhead a movement. We know that there are a lot of self-publishing platforms and ways to get your work out to the masses without going through a traditional publisher. And for many years, those methods have kind of been looked down on and seen as maybe less than, or if you went that route, maybe there was something kind of, you know, maybe wrong with your work. Basically, you know, I know one of the big things here in the pagan community is that getting published through one of the big two, I guess you could call it, Llewellyn and Wiser, you know, getting published with one of those sort of confers legitimacy upon you, your work, your teaching. I mean, gosh, if you say that you published a book with Llewellyn or you published a book with Wiser, you could pretty much guarantee that your whole summer is going to be filled up with speaking engagements and pagan prides and all sorts of stuff. I mean, there's money to be had there if you want it. What Aiden has done is become successful without that. Now, certainly Aiden's name has already been out there. He was a talismanic jeweler of great renown for many years prior to writing his first book, which was Six Ways. But he has gone on to become an outright pagan bestseller without going through a traditional publisher, doing everything himself. And he'll tell you later that it's because, you know, he went that route because he's sort of a control freak and certainly likes to handle most parts of the book creation and publication and dissemination process himself. But there are a lot of folks out there that have written very kind, in-depth reviews of Aiden's work and saying, you know, you could get rid of an entire shelf of those big two published books and just put Aiden's book on there. And I'm not saying that you could or should do that, but what I am saying is that there is a lot of really great quality content out there that isn't part of the current big two traditionally pagan published pipeline. And I think that the success of Aiden's book is something to celebrate. And as one reviewer put it that we're going to talk about later in the show, it might be something that Llewellyn and Wiser want to start paying attention to. You know, one reviewer said that basically the model of publish any pretty much everything that you get, hoping that somebody is the next Scott Cunningham, might not be the best way for a publishing house to work going forward. And there's a lot of discussion to be had as to whether or not that's a good argument. That's maybe an argument for another day, and I know Aiden and I talk about that later. But today we are going to be talking to Aiden about his book, Weaving Fate. I did want to say that if you are a Patreon supporter, you heard this episode first. So this is nothing new to you. This is a much bigger conversation than we normally have, and you guys got to hear it first. If you would like to become a Patreon supporter, if you'd like to get access to this kind of content before everyone else does, and certainly in its unedited form, folks that support the show get full audio and full video interviews before they happen, sometimes days, sometimes weeks before. And it's always just sort of the full, dirty, gross, unedited version, which at times means that you guys get about an extra half hour or so of content. Sometimes it's a little bit more, sometimes it's a little bit less, but there's usually quite a bit of content where me and my guest or me and whoever I'm talking to are sort of sitting there talking, and sometimes some really cool discussions come up that never make it to the main show. So if you'd like to become a Patreon supporter, you can do that for as little as a dollar a month by going to patreon.com/incitingprojects. I have talked a very long time. You're not here to hear me. You're not. I know you're not. Let's get straight to that conversation with Aiden Wachter. Aiden Wachter, welcome back to Inciting a Riot. I am so glad to have you here today. First crisp day of, I guess it's fall. It's Labor Day weekend when we're recording this. It's sort of fallish. How are you, sir?
I'm good. It definitely feels a little fallish here.
It does. It does. It's nice and cool in the morning. You still have that like window of warmth in the mm-hmm. the middle of the day, but it's like blanket in the morning, blanket in the evening, might need a jacket or a hoodie.
Yeah, we're starting to get like, I think we're supposed to get down to like 46 at night where we are soon.
Oh God, so, I'm not looking forward to that.
We're at elevation, so it comes on fast.
We're in the Chicago area, and it's, you know, we get the deep cold in the winter, but I at least it's still just a little ways off for us.
We'll be cold by the end of October for sure. Yeah, we'll probably have snow in October. So,
don't speak that into existence. Speaking of October,
okay,
are you guys
away from here?
Are you guys like full on spooky season where you are, or are you like leaving that to like October 1st?
That doesn't really happen here.
Oh,
we're in one of those places that doesn't really exist. Part of it is we're so rural.
Uh huh.
You know, we're on dirt, off dirt. People don't let their kids out to do that stuff. So people do a little bit of decorating at their houses, and then for us, you can't see where we live from the dirt road that we're on. We're way down a really long driveway, mm-hmm. couple of gates. It's very, even though it's a tiny property, it's very much coming onto the ranch. And not tiny by city levels, but tiny for out here. So we've not ever really got into it here. It's like, okay, there's really no reason. It's you and I and the dogs and the chickens. Nobody cares.
Y'all don't go full out in your house or anything. We're not turning it into like the witchy cottage out in the dirt.
No, there's no room to do that. It's a tiny, you know, we've got like 650 square feet. We're in a tiny little place. It's already the witchy cottage.
Nice. So, nice.
There's nothing to be done.
So, Aiden, you are joining the illustrious group of those of us that put a book out in 2020.
Absolutely.
Smack Amazingly. Dab in the middle of quarantine trying to promote this book.
And it feels good.
Your book has gotten a lot of love from the witchy blogosphere. Your book is called Weaving Fate. When was your first book published? I feel like it wasn't that long ago. You've got a quick turnaround.
It was about 2.5 years ago.
That's pretty quick for a sequel book, I feel like, at least for good sequel books. Some people can churn out these sequels once a year, and it's like, you said that last year, but
yeah. Well, thank you for thinking it's a good one. In both cases, the book was done and then got shelved for other projects, or mostly done, you know, final edits weren't done. And so it was kind of in both cases, we hit places where we could kind of go, okay, let's finish that book now. Mm-hmm. So there's actually a wider gap between them than is apparent by the publication.
Gotcha.
Date.
So this is a RuPaul illusion.
It's an illusion.
Wig reveal, like the wig was there all the time kind of thing.
Yeah, totally. Nice. And I kind of knew I had I've got basically since Six Ways was published and probably 6 months after, I've had four books in process. Mm-hmm. And so this one had kind of shown me what it was going to be. And then we hit a point where we needed to pause. So it seemed like it was a normal time frame. So
nice.
It didn't seem compressed at all.
So you said, the book showed you what it was going to be. What is Weaving Fate about? I mean, you've got some pretty interesting language in your subtitle there. Hyper sigils, changing the past, telling true lies. This is intriguing.
So Six Ways I viewed as kind of like, from talking to people because of the talismanic work I was doing at the time, I was like, there's a bunch of stuff that are ways that I think about kind of basic practices mm-hmm. and foundational practices that I think will be useful, mm-hmm. That I've not seen kind of pulled together in one place. Not saying that they're entirely original or anything like that, but that there's an angle to them and that creating like a handbook somebody could kind of get into and out of all sorts of, good magical trouble. And then really Weaving Fate came about when I was talking to Chawan Ku at Witches and Wine, mm-hmm. her podcast. And she asked me a couple questions about Six Ways that were really like, how would you have somebody who is a rank beginner try and do work, mm-hmm. right? And this kind of triggered a bunch of thought processes that tapped into most of the other books that I'm working on. And this is not that they're rank beginner books at all, but like, okay, if Six Ways is the overview of tools, right, that are kind of the best tools, how do I actually radical change? And in Weaving Fate's case, that is kind of my main practices for doing that personally for a long time. And they're really low tech. They don't require you to have, been meditating for 6 years or being able to see spirits or anything like that. But they function as advertised for everybody that I've kind of run through the processes.
So what is a hyper sigil? I like the explanation on your website. I certainly enjoy a crossover with a comic book.
So hyper sigils are something that the term comes from Grant Morrison, mm-hmm. Who created The Filth and The Invisibles, and he did the current TV thing of Brave New World. He's the writer on, and he's got another show called Happy that's running. And Grant is kind of a wild character. And I had stumbled onto a process that became what the Black Book, which is the hyper sigil piece of Weaving Fate, is before I'd run across Morrison, as far as I know. I've tried to figure that out, and I think that that's true. And the idea behind a hyper sigil is, if a sigil is like, how do you kind of code an intention or desire into a really simple little seed packet, right? Mm-hmm. In a really easy way. The hyper sigil is kind of the explosion of that, which is, how do you codify a life you desire into some form of narrative arc that you can kind of work over a very long period of time and adjust over very long periods of time? And so Weaving Fate is my approach to hyper sigils. And it's a journal form. So it's, how can you contemplate how you want your life to actually play out and write about that?
So I find it really interesting, sort of the language surrounding hyper sigils. Again, one of the examples that you give on your website is that an entire comic book series was a hyper sigil. A mm-hmm. book can be a hyper sigil. when you think of sigils, I mean, you think of, you know, those simple, sometimes runic looking symbols mm-hmm. that you create and you know, give intention to, and other people can give intention to them. You know, there's a number of sort of big name pagans out there right now that are doing a lot of sigil work, mass sigil work for mm-hmm. civil unrest and you know, in support of Black Lives Matter and things like that. And but that's not what a hypersigil is. A hypersigil seems to be a greater work that might not necessarily have these runic looking sigils inside of it. It's a work. It's a creative work.
Yeah. So the way that I talk about hypersigils mostly, because they can take tons of different forms. You know, there's people that are doing video. There are people who are doing, you know, novels or graphic novels or things like that. So a hypersigil is like a long form narrative form of magic. Mm-hmm. And how I think about it is, if you think about, what's a good example? So I could think of a few. If you think of certain books that are, these could be let's pick like a Charles DeLint book, right? Okay. So this is a good example of somebody who's mostly now writing about people living in the modern times, but who are kind of falling into enchanted states of being, right? With the concept of the hypersigil, you could do that to yourself or for yourself and maybe not have the kind of harrowing, crazy stuff that is why everybody gets forced into it to keep the book exciting in Charles DeLint's books. But yeah, if you were to say, here are the five things that I would like in my life to be very different, instead of coming at them straight on like you would with a sigil or with a spell, piece of spell work, with a hypersigil, you begin to try and, again, create a narrative where those things are true. And so in the Black Book, since it's a journal, you're journaling as if these things have come to pass, and how you feel about them, how they felt, how they played out. If you were looking for a romantic partner, how did that happen? How did it come together? And it's not that you're necessarily trying to produce that exact result, that if you write, I met her in the coffee shop or met him in the bar or whatever, that's not necessarily what you're really looking for. But you're just kind of setting up scenarios to your brain or to your mind and to the field and to the others going, I would like this to happen, and I'm open to how it happens. And I talk about this in the book a lot, is can we look at this in a whole bunch of different ways? So maybe I'm going to say I met this guy in the bar. Maybe I met this guy at work. Maybe I met this guy at the gym. Maybe I met this guy. And we don't try and pick one. We kind of throw them all out there as possibilities. But what we want is, we want to hit the characteristics of what we want from that experience. So not necessarily even being consistent about what the guy looks like mm-hmm. or their name or what they're into. But what we're after is, can we get ourselves involved in this process so much that we start writing about how we feel about it? What is it? How do we feel when we wake up in bed next to that person? What's that morning like? What is making breakfast with that person like? And it's an interesting little process. And what I found from doing this kind of very experimentally, because I was, again, not really aware of anybody doing this at the time I started, was that if you did this and kept it really wide open that way and really focused on kind of the feeling sense and the experience of the end state instead of how you got there, and kind of played with all of the different ways you could think of how you'd get there, that it really strange levels of kind of similarity and synchronicity would kick up. And you would begin to go, wait a second. I met this girl and I'm waking up in bed next to her, and I'm actually kind of having the conversation in my head that I wrote about. And she's not exactly what I wrote about necessarily in my physical description. Maybe she's got black hair. And in my description, she had red hair. But this is that thing that has come to pass, you know. So it's an interesting and very different form of magic from what is generally taught, I think.
Yeah, the thing that I really loved about your explanation of the hypersigil, your explanation of sort of this storytelling as magic, as a form of magic, is that is always the form of magic that felt the most true to me, the most accessible to me. And it was always the kind of magic that I relied on personally, you know, when I wanted to do something really effective. And I guess I never really knew that it was called a hypersigil, but I remember the earliest time. So normally in like fiction, you know, the magic takes the form of a wand or a power word or, you know, a rhyming couplet or something like that. But there were a few works of fiction that I've read that did this sort of like storytelling magic. I remember the first one that I read was the So You Want to Be a Wizard books from the early 80s by Diane Duane. And another one that came out this year by Maggie Takuda Hall, The Mermaid, the Witch, and the Sea. Both of those use storytelling as a form of magic. You know, I'm sort of reminding the water of what it was like when it was cold and it became ice. And I, you know, I'm reminding the rock of what it was like when it was part of the mountain, and, you know, weaving these intricate, stories that end up creating an effect on the world. And I don't normally see that in fiction, and I don't normally see that in, you know, in nonfiction instructional magical texts like yours. And so it was such a joy to see that kind of idea put down onto paper, because when I've stumbled across that in fiction, that has felt very real to me. And I've always sort of thought, gosh, you know, when you read myths and you have a storytelling god who tells a story that comes to pass, when you read, stories where these kinds of magical acts, you know, weave fate, to borrow your novel title, that just has always felt so true to me. What kind of reaction have you seen from people that have gotten this lesson from you?
It's pretty interesting. I get two primary responses, which is that there's the standard one that I get for a lot of my stuff, which this isn't magic because it's not controlled enough, essentially. And that's always been funny to me.
Me too.
It's like, really, what kind of magic are you doing that's that controlled? Because
I imagine this person has a lot of beakers and goggles and things like that.
I don't know, but and for everybody, the people that it has clicked for is just like, oh, this makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And for me, it is interesting because I believe that I got the idea for this and the original working title for this book, because I always have to come up with a working title and it never survives the process, was The Blessed Hell Ride. And this is a two-parter for me. It's a two-part, not exactly joke, but there's a joke aspect to it. That The Blessed Hell Ride is a song from the Black Label Society, basically about the insanity of being on the road as a rock musician, you know. But the Hell Ride concept comes from the Amber books by Roger Zelazny. I don't know if you ever read those. They're quite
I
old
haven't,
now.
No.
They're really good. The first series, there's two series, basically. And so the first series runs from a book called Nine Princes in Amber to the last book is, pardon me, The Courts of Chaos. And in this book, there is a bunch of concepts that are kind of touched on in Weaving Fate. And it's not that I take them wholeheartedly, but I read these very young and they were in my mind as I began practicing magic. And how it works is that for some of the people in this book or in these books, they come from a place that they refer to as the true realm, which is Amber. And everything else in the multiverse is basically slightly altered reflections, right? but there's unlimited worlds that they have access to. And how they can travel through these is this process called the Hell Ride. And the Hell Ride, I think, is a brilliant metaphor for magic. So they can do it walking, but they usually do it in cars or on horses or whatever. And they will take off traveling across the countryside, wherever they are, and it'll be the grass is green and it's stands of pine trees and there is a river on one side and there are mountains to the west. The sky is blue, the sun is yellow. And where they want to go to this other world they want to go, that's not what it is. So they begin seeing if they can change kind of consciously aspects using kind of their, what we would think of as psychic powers for us, and go, okay, I want the river to be on the other side of the road. And after a while, they realize that they're riding and the river is now on the other side of the road. And the grass should be bluer rather than green. And after a while, if they do this successfully, the grass becomes blue and eventually, oh, the sky is purple now. We're getting closer, right? And so they're basically consciously removing elements from their world and replacing them with elements of the world they want to be in. And to me, this is magic, right?
That's absolutely
the best description I can think of.
It reminds me of that scene in one of the early Sandman comics where Dream is having a battle in hell, and mm-hmm. the battle isn't some grand magical, you know, he's not throwing fireballs out of his hands or something. It's a storytelling battle. They go to a jazz club mm-hmm. and they have this metaphysical storytell off. Almost
exactly,
and I'm like, that's magic, or that's magic to me, I guess.
It's totally how I feel about it. It was funny. So I had gotten deep into the magical stuff, and I think I read the Zelazny books when I was, you know, maybe 13 or 14 at the oldest, and then I came back to them in my late 20s, and I was like, oh, I don't know whether I just can now see this in this way or whether this has always been a filter over how I think about magic. But that idea of, yeah, if you, instead of saying, I want to live in this million-dollar mansion, or I want to live in the south of France and doing spells to get you to the south of France, what if you just wrote as if you were there mm-hmm. and did some magical work around that writing? And to me, it's just it's a very elegant form of spell work.
It is an elegant form of spell work. Your book is so complex, though, without needing to be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages long. And I want to comment on something and bring up some of the words of Chaz Clifton, who wrote a brief blog on your new work. And he said in a blog that he posted on August 24th, he says, today I heard a podcast host say what I have been thinking from when I bought the book last year. Aidan Wachter's Six Ways, Approaches and Entries for Practical Magic has more content in 155 or so pages than a shelf full of Llewellyn books. I fantasize that witches, magicians, and sorcerers of all sorts are sweeping their shelves of books with the familiar crescent moon on the spine and tossing them into cartons to take to the nearest used bookstore to sell or to trade for store credit. Six Ways' success threatens the old model of printing lots of occult books in small press runs and waiting to see if any author is the next Scott Cunningham. And now there is another one coming, Weaving Fate, Changing the Past, and Telling True Lies. The ebook is available. The paperback is on the way. Your book and your writing generally, first of all, has a lovely little orange number one new release bestseller flag on Amazon, and it is a hit. It's a true success. It's about as successful, I think, as any other witchy pagany book can be these days. And you did this yourself.
mm-hmm.
You did this yourself. Is there something that was important to you about putting the work out yourself, or what led you to independent publishing?
There's a mountain climber who's actually better known for training the guys from 300 to look super ripped, Mark Twight, and I use his term a lot, which is, I'm a control enthusiast. is a big part of it. And that's both a joke and not a joke as a magical person. I've never been comfortable handing off my work to someone else, mm-hmm. to then edit, to then format, to then decide how it's illustrated, to then decide the cover, or decide how it's marketed. And some of this is, it's actually, if I think about it, I had a few pieces published in the 90s in magazines that mm-hmm. had some weird changes done to them, or where the formatting got mangled in a way that changed the message, I thought, you know? And so I've never been willing to do that. And part of a lot of my whole approach to magic is that this is something that anybody can do. Mm-hmm. And I do actually feel the same way now with the way that the world is about things like books. It doesn't mean it's the right choice for everyone. Mm-hmm. But there's no reason, if you have something to put out, to think you have to have a big publisher for it. And where Chaz Clifton said something that I think people that don't really know the book industry took it in a way that is harsher than it is. And he commented on that and somewhere else and kind of tried to explain a little bit. But all of the publishing houses that are big, so I'm not including things like Scarlet Imprint or Revelor or something like that, are doing this thing, which is you got to produce a lot of stuff to get the piece that goes, right? Mm-hmm. So we know, I'm friends with Matt Oren online, and we know that his book is one of those books that, his book Psychic Witch, which is a great book, is one of those books that Llewellyn is always hoping they get, mm-hmm. right? That it's like, okay, yeah. The print runs keep getting bigger and keep selling out. That's what they're after. And as yes. a big publisher, you have to be after that because you can't do it otherwise. Right. So it's no judgment from me on Llewellyn at all, or Wiser, or any of that. But we know from anybody that's in that, if you know anybody that's in that game, there's a very short window where they can afford to promote your book to see if it catches on. Mm-hmm. And unless something really freaky happens and it catches on in a huge way years later, that window is just closed when it's closed. It's not that you're going to go out of the catalog. It's not that it's going to cease to be there. But all of that stuff, I can't really do. It's just not in my nature to go, I'm going to hand this to you and let you decide whether it comes out in a year or 2 years. And part of that also sinks in, like with Weaving Fate, why we switched gears to get that book out is it seemed like it was the most useful book for the time we're in mm-hmm. of the ones that I'm working on. Like we're in a specific moment where I think that book could help. And so if I'd handed that to any of the big publishers, we wouldn't see it till way further down the road. And it's not to say that it won't be of use then, but to us, our take was, people could use this right now. Mm-hmm. If we can get it to them right now with all of the kind of crazy changes due to the pandemic and the kind of social movement going on right now and the insanity of United States politics and the great uncertainty, this is a very useful toolkit to try and navigate that. So all of those reasons are why I go solo. You know?
Do you think that the success of books like yours would have an effect on, or maybe should they have, maybe that's the better question, should they have an effect on the state of pagan publishing now? Not publishing in general, but pagan publishing specifically, this particular niche with our tiny publishers as they are, should, you know, do you think that this is some kind of wake-up call that maybe we should be treating publishing a little differently in our community?
It's hard to say, in part because I don't read a lot of what comes out now. So mm-hmm. I don't want to judge. The only things that I've really read that are kind of in that run are things that I've been sent actually from folks that I know to do kind of, editorial reviews on. Sure. And they've all been fabulous. So it's a little rough for me to make that judgment. For me, I think that that is there's something to that, and more than even what I, and I'm not going to take any credit on my end for it, but I think that that's what I see through Scarlet Imprint. And though I have less interest than I did at some point in their work overall, I see that in some of what comes out of Three Hands Press, definitely what's coming out of Revelor Press, that I think people, we probably talked about this the last time, I'm not sure, but people are smarter than they are given credit for, mm-hmm. by almost any form of commercial endeavor, as far as I'm concerned. And that is, I think, the key, that if somebody wanted to try and take away something from kind of, let's say, the smaller press, pagan and magical stuff, is that like people want guts. People want something that's different. Well, there's something comfortable to getting versions of the same thing. But there's a point where that becomes like, okay, it's not that I want a hamburger at a different restaurant. It's that I want something different.
Well, one of the most common questions that I think just about any pagan podcaster would tell you that we get in our inboxes, especially when we do those, like, you know, hey, we're going to do a big Q&A roundup episode or something like that. One of the questions that inevitably I will get in my inbox is, what do I read after 101 books? Okay, mm-hmm. I've read all the 101 books, and no shade on publishers that put out another 50 101 books every year. I get it. Those are your bread and butter. I mean, they make you money. You're publishing them because they make you money, and you're a business. You're trying to make money. But there is a need for material beyond the introduction to terms, the introduction to seasons, the introduction to sort of the basics of yes, hey, magic is real. Okay, let's move on now. Is what to read next. And I would absolutely put your books on any 201 list. Like, okay, you understand basic terminology. Where do you go next? And we're not mm-hmm. getting into some deeply complex, you know, stereo instructions kind of book. These are short, but they are incredibly content filled. With practical, real world knowledge and information and fresh ideas. And I think that it's so important to have that kind of sort of 201. What am I doing the sophomore year of my magical studies? I think it's so important to have that kind of information out there. Do you think, I mean, you know, is that something that you also look for? What kind of, when you get those questions, where do you turn people to for beyond 101 information?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually very tricky. And so I tend to turn people to stuff that isn't necessarily magical books.
I'm so glad you said that, because that's what I always say. I'm like, okay, so you're going to have to get out of the witchy section of the bookstore, and you're going to need to go to the history section. I need you to go to the art section. I need you to go to sociology.
Right. So, like, you know, the book that I really recommend to everybody, and I don't think I actually put it in the suggested reading in the first edition of Weaving Fate, but I'll have to rectify that, is I send everybody to this book that you can read for free online at JSTOR, or if you have a JSTOR membership or want to get one for $10 a month, you can download a PDF of it. And it's, I think it's only about 70 pages long, and it's really a reprint in a journal from the 80s, I think. But anyway, it's called The Black Faith, by Dorji Bonsurov. And it's a look at Mongolian shamanism that was written in the 1800s, in the 18 somethings. And it's written by a Mongolian.
Incredible. And revolutionary concept.
Yeah. And he's basically, and Bonsurov is a tragic story. He didn't live very long and had a rough ride on the way out, for sure. But basically what he's saying is, like, look, all you guys are coming in here and looking at this stuff with so many filters on that you can't hear what the guys that are talking to you are saying. And it's this critical piece of information that I think gets missed so much, which is, like, can you drop the filters? can you come in at it and say, not what does this look like? And then can I find something else that this looks like that is comfortable to me? And I can say, oh, this then is just like this. Mm-hmm. Right. Which is unfortunately what we do as humans. Right? It's this categorization process that doesn't tend to serve us. And so Bonzeroff in a couple of places, like one of the ones he says, you know, the anthropologists come through here, they talk to people, they discover that there are spirits in some of the stones. And they go, the Mongolians believe that there are spirits in all of the stones. He goes, and that's not what they're saying at all. And he's saying, they're saying that there are spirits in some of the stones. And then they go, okay, so the stones have, stones are alive. And he goes, and this is also not right. He says, to the Mongolian, some stones are alive because there are spirits that are indwelling in the stones, right? This is incredibly sophisticated thinking for that period of time, mm-hmm. right? And it's kind of sophisticated thinking for now.
Sure.
Because it's easier to say, everything is alive.
Everything, right? Yeah.
Everything is alive. My desk from, which is a workbench from the Home Depot.
But don't
is
ask
alive.
Too many questions about that.
Let's not go in.
Everything is alive. But I have questions. What about, why did we do this to the, no, shh. Everything's alive, but just shh.
Exactly. And so to me, it's like looking at things, like you said, so there's interesting things that you find in anthropology, like, you know, a lot of folks that are kind of in the traditional witchcraft stuff got a lot of really good stuff out of Eva Pox, Emma Wilby, Claude Lecoteau does a lot of very good thinking in that he's really upfront. Like I've been reading, The Return of the Dead by him. And up front, he's like, look, we have to look at the Christian stuff, but we kind of don't have to take it seriously. Right? We're not going to take those people's perspectives here. We have to try and pull their perspectives off of this, because this is not what the perspective of the people that they're writing about. Right? We just have to know that that's a fact. And onward into things like, there's a brilliant book by, and I don't know how you pronounce either of her names, but Avital Ronell, called The Telephone Book, that was hugely influential on me. That was a kind of really intense academic and poetic look at what are the, when you're looking at electronic communication, so this is way before internet was anything that we would think of, I think it existed a little bit for the military at that point, but that was it. She's saying, so when we come into these electronic communication tools like the telephone, what are we agreeing to simply because we pick up the phone and say yes? What does this mean? Right? And this level of thinking was very useful to me because I'd never been exposed to it. I didn't make it anywhere near through. I left high school after a year, so I didn't make it into college or any of that. I never had an epistemology class or anything like that. And so coming across somebody that was thinking that way and going, you've already agreed. If you pick up the phone and say yes, you've agreed to something, mm-hmm. and you don't know what. And what is this saying? That's where she starts the book, and it's uh-huh. dense. It goes way beyond that. And so things like that were very helpful to me.
But that's such an interesting magical concept, though, that, you know, I take a step into the moonlight. I answer the call of a deity. I take the first step and I have made an agreement. I just don't know what I've agreed to quite yet. I don't know the boundaries of this agreement. I don't even know the content of this agreement. I just know that I have said yes to something. And I think mm-hmm. that's such an interesting, magical concept that gosh, that could be explored in such depth.
And I think that that's, to me, what's interesting. And that's part of what I try and do both in Six Ways and in Weaving Fate is really go. And so like in Weaving Fate, I go down a particular pathway which I'm sure some people will be turned off by based on my own things, which is a critique of modern civilization sure. as, is this, can we really qualify this as being advanced in kind of human terms? You know, but part of that is not because it, it's not because of the specifics of that conversation. It's just like, what are the filters we're operating through? What are overlaid upon us and what did we take from it? I don't think everybody will come to the same conclusions I do. I don't know that I will always hold the same conclusion I've come to at the point that I was writing the book, right? And I had to kind of be really comfortable with that, going like, there's nothing to defend or to protect within there. The idea is, are we looking at the situation that we're in? Are we looking at the agreements that we have made? I don't even remember if this part made it in. Are we kind of, we live in a culture that to me is deeply enmeshed in forcing meaning on everyone. So if you like this, then you are this kind of a person, and that's either acceptable or unacceptable, right? If you would consider this point of view, even just consider it, then this means you are this kind of person, for better or worse. And if we bring that into our magical practices, then we go, it's something that I've talked about on the in the Six Ways Facebook group a lot is, and I brought it up again recently, like if you work primarily with a singular deity or a singular spirit and your life isn't improving, what is wrong in that relationship? Right. And we can bring this home, right? Mm-hmm. We can say, okay, if you are in love with someone deeply, but your life is hell because of that, is that worth that to you? Right.
You just read my little 15-year-old gay heart to filth, man. All those little gay boys being in love with all those straight football kids. Oh, man.
Totally. I am with you.
No, it was not worth it, by the way, to answer you. It's not worth it.
No, but we do this, and I think we do this on so many levels. And so for me, the issue of where do you go after the 101 or the 201 and I think that to me, that's what the 201 books should be, is like exploring kind of, you've got some basic skills. You can do some kind of magic. It doesn't have to be, and that's, you know, one of the big things I harp on all the time is you don't need to know how to do every kind of magic. The fact that all of the astrologers believe that astrology is incredibly important is important because they're astrologers. And it's not saying that it's not useful. It's just saying that's why it's so important to them. Just like the folklorists believe folklore is crucial, and you know, it's all the same thing. But can we start to share how we think, mm-hmm. on really deep levels and on really personal levels about the experiences that we're having, and where do we get stuck and how do we get unstuck? Which again, I was a total freaky kid growing up. And so I had to kind of go, okay, is it okay that, you know, by the time I was, you know, 17 or whatever, I'd been in bed with boys and girls and I wasn't sure if I was straight or gay or bi or any of those things. Like, is this okay? Now there's the cultural, is this okay? And in different cultures, that's a yes or a no or a hell no or a hell yes, right? But am I okay with it? Mm-hmm. And am I okay with the fact that I may not know? I may not know if I am bi or if I am gay or if I am straight or if the fact that I can cross-dress well enough to pass when I was that young. Are these things definitions? Are these things that I do? Are these things that I am? Is there a reality to the concept of permanence behind them? Do I have to have an answer to any of those questions, right? This is all kind of, it's beyond magic 201. It's just kind of like being a human 201, right? And so that's, I think, where the focus to me is on that stuff. It's like, you don't need a ton of tools to do very effective magic. Don't need, you, and I talk about this all the time. You need one or two. You need one or two thing that works for you, and that's it. It doesn't matter. But again, if we kind of throw into this, there's so much forcing of meaning. There is so much gatekeeping in all aspects of our current cultural life. It's not just magic, so I'm not just bagging on the occult world. So then, to me, the really fascinating questions become, okay, so you got this candle spell that you really like, and you can use it to get laid or get a better job or kind of improve your communication with the unseen. Okay, now here's 201. What does that mean to your self-identity, to your understanding of the world, to your understanding of what magic is and can be, and on and on and on? That should open tons of questions. And instead, what I think through the kind of, this goes back to the publishing thing, because we're such a publishing driven and book driven subculture, the marketing side says, well, you need to acquire more skills. And it's like, why? What do you get from acquiring another set of spell skills?
Well, you get to join the Justice League, clearly.
You get to join the Justice League.
You get to join the Justice League.
Totally. And so it's an interesting thing. But to me, that's the real thing, is like, what does this mean? Because if sigil magic works, doesn't that reframe the entirety of the reality that you were raised to believe in? If devotional work to Athena does something really potent to you, why do you have to take that on in the way other people take on religious devotional work? What does it mean to you? What does it say about your reality, your existence, the reality of that other being, all of those things? That to me is 201.
I want to ask you a question that is also on sort of that list that we all get when we ask for questions. And it's, how do you square when magic doesn't work? Or are you part of the camp that says magic always works?
That's a total maybe. I tend to think that magic is the kind of way that the world works. And so magic is always working, but this doesn't necessarily mean that every act of magic works, right? Every attempt doesn't necessarily work. Because kind of it's, and it also goes to some interesting definitions, which is it like gymnastics? You know, we're in the Olympics where works is that you actually executed every piece of it flawlessly and you got, you know, a high enough score to get medal and get up on the podium. Is that what we're looking for? Or are we looking at it as the skills development behind that? Like, okay, well, there's the other 80,000 hours that those gymnasts that we see at the Olympics put in. And did that not work because they didn't get medaled? Right? Or are we looking at this as a way of approaching the world? And yeah, that there's going to be pieces that work. There are conversations with my wife that don't work. this doesn't mean that we should stop doing them or that they were failures. It didn't get us what we wanted out of the thing. So there's that side of it. And then my personal take is that the allies are way, I'm a straight up spirit dude. I don't have any question. I have been cured of my need to have questions about that, or of my needs to try and explain what my position on that, but I'm a straight up spirit based thing. I think the Allies just stop a bunch of shit. I think that there's things that we want that the Allies are like, no.
sort of like when your mom sees you trying to, you know, use the stove.
Yeah, and it's you're just you're wasted at that party, and you're trying to like take off your clothes, and because you want to get fucked. And your friends put you in your jacket and drag you to the car and take you home. Like, yes, that piece of magic failed.
I feel very personally attacked on this interview today. I'm just feeling very... gosh. I'm just going to wear extra layers in all my selfies from now on. No, but I like what you say about... you know, there is a middle ground between magic doesn't work and magic always works. And there's a skill, there's a learned set of skills. You can learn different kinds of skills. And just because you didn't land the, you know, triple
whatever.
You didn't
stick it. Yeah.
Yeah. You didn't stick it today doesn't mean that you can't stick it in practice, that you can't stick it some other time. You can stick it wherever you want. But I appreciate that there is, there's becoming more, I feel, and maybe I'm just a crazy person. But I think that there is more of an appreciation for the praxis of craft rather than effectiveness is the wrong word, but it's the only word that's coming to mind, but rather than the effectiveness of craft, rather than the need for the bullet to always, you know, hit the bullseye or whatever. And I hesitate to call it ritual because ritual feels like it has a spiritual connotation, and some people that work magic aren't spirit guys like you. But I appreciate that there is becoming an appreciation for the praxis, the actual just act of doing work. Because for a very long time,
long
time. So, but I appreciate that there is this sort of, I don't know if it was a return for a love of praxis or the sort of just rejuvenation of the love of praxis. But, you know, there seems to be much more of an appreciation in books that have come out and in people's YouTube videos and podcasts and stuff for just the simple act of doing the stuff. And why I appreciate that is because for a very long time, long time, I feel like if you wanted to do a job, you lit a candle and you waited. And that was sort of the message in some books, is that here's your job spell. And there's not a lot of discussion in the chapter on the spells that if you want to get a job, don't just light the candle. You're going to have to go put out some applications.
Totally.
And the while I realize that for some, the response to that is, well, of course you also need to put out some applications. Since you didn't say it in the chapter, there's like a whole generation of folks out there, of magical practitioners, that think that lit candle equals the job fairy is going to come and grant you with a job. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate this love of praxis because it is instilling in magical practitioners, magical seekers, this understanding that there is work to do. And it's not just the witchy work, it's the practical, actual, real world stuff you should be doing alongside it to create effective spellcraft. I mean, you know, your own recommendation, your own information on hypersigils, you know, the idea that a creative work, a story, a painting, a something, you know, can be the act of magic itself, or can seek to weave fate, as it were. You know, what I appreciate about that is that it doesn't say you stop working there. You continue to live your life and you continue to work towards that goal. You just might start noticing these synchronicities. You might start noticing how roads realign themselves to get you to your end point. And I appreciate this return to praxis. How do you feel about the notion of magic doing all the work versus none of the work versus some of the work? Where do you fall on that spectrum?
Well, I think it's just kind of a crazy concept that it would do all of the work. And that kind of ties into the kind of Hollywood take on magic to me. That if magic is an approach to life, then you got to do the life, right? and part of that is that there's a bunch of grunt work, right? And this happens on all levels. I tried to show that in the hypersigil, where our friend who is working the hypersigil process is like both like doing kind of this projected fantasy aspect and then the mundane side simultaneously. Because this is the only way that works, right? Is you got to go, okay, if I want to be in position X and I know that there are 20 changes that have to occur, I need to begin making those changes. And I'm going to certainly use magic to assist, and perhaps some of them will just fall into place, right? But I shouldn't assume that everything is simply going to fall into place because I've done a piece of magic. To me, again, it's like whether you want to talk about the allies or not, it's kind of, you also got to show you're serious. This is the other thing that I was taught early on.
Well, what I love is that using your earlier example of, okay, so say you want to live in the south of France. You don't just like light a candle and etch the word south of France into the wax and then like light the candle and think it's done. In your example, there's sort of a storytelling aspect of how did I get to France? What roads realigned themselves? What did I need to get to France?
Right.
And there is the magical intentional aspect that puts this metaphysical energy to work to get you to the south of France. But there's also sort of the mental checklist that you had to do while creating your hypersigil, while writing this story, that you kind of had to remind yourself, well, there's work to do to get to the south of France. You know, I had to figure out the job situation. I had to figure out or the money situation, however I was going to afford to get to the south of France. There's the living situation. There's the people that I need to know along the way.
Right.
Which sort of creates the practical checklist in your head of the things you should be doing. You need
and
to do
they
it.
Should be. And the thing that I think is interesting that I get, you know, I also get contacted by people who are doing crazy ass spell work that doesn't have any grounding in their reality. Mm-hmm. And they're not doing any kind of mundane work,
sure,
for lack of a better term, is that same thing. Is also, if your goal is to move to the south of France within a few years, are you paying attention to what visa requirements are,
sure,
to what customs requirements are, to what are they going to expect of you to even consider you? Because you also, and it's not saying don't do work about that, but if you have, I don't know, a criminal issue that you need to get resolved, if you have credit issues, you're probably going to need to get those resolved before some other country is going to let you come in unless you just have buckets of money. How big of a bucket of money do you have to have? Do you really need to marry someone and that's the only way that's happening? Okay, then how do we begin this process, right? And this should generate, like you said, it's kind of like the work list, right? Mm-hmm. These are the things that have to change. And I think that with what we're talking about, that's kind of the step that I think can get missed unless you really do dive into it, is this kind of holistic practice. Like, I want to be over there and my life doesn't look anything like that. What are the components,
yes,
of a life that would have me end up there? And let's start going through that list and let's start knocking off the low-hanging fruit and kind of learning what the hard to get to pieces are and see if we need to know different people, if we need to develop skills that we don't have, if we need paperwork we don't have, if we need to stop moving around because they're going to want to see stability, mm-hmm, depending on what the situation is, right? It's just tons of stuff. And I don't think we can separate that, to me, from magical practice, because this is what magical practice is kind of, to me, it's like asking us to look at all of these pieces and go, really, it's not about fantasizing myself into a different world, though that would be nice, you know. It's, if I really want to be in that different world, how do I have to change? And that's another piece that doesn't get discussed as much as it should, though I'm seeing more of it on kind of online at least, which is, if you want to have a totally different life, you're probably going to be a fairly different person. So what is that person like? Because the person that you are right now is the person that is living the life you are right now. So if you're looking for subtle changes, this isn't really something you have to consider. But if you're really looking for the insanely radical changes, which a lot of people are, and I am all for, I'm a big fan of this, who do you have to become to even inhabit that place in a coherent fashion? And start working on that, both magically and on the mundane. And that, I think, is the nature of magical practice.
So this year has been a big year in a lot of ways, not just the pandemic that has sort of shut a lot of life down, or a lot of how we used to live life, but there has been a lot of waking up in society, at least here in the U.S., but it does seem that that has carried around the world. Has there been anything about the social awakening that's happened over the last several months, and it's been bubbling under the surface the last several years, that has changed your thought process around your own practice, that has changed your thought process about what kind of spiritual information you take in, who you're reading, what you're listening to, what you're watching, you know, your spiritual world, your mundane world? Has there been anything about that that has created some new alignments for you?
Yeah, there's been a lot. Some of it is interesting. You know, I have dear friends or family who are trans, who are every part of the sexual spectrum, gender spectrum, all kind of skin colors and ethnic backgrounds. And it's a very interesting time, and also kind of for America, as we talk about America up here, but the United States, it's a very kind of sketchy time, because a lot has been revealed, I think, that was comfortably ignored since probably, you know, and this is, some of this is even before my time, but it was present enough, you know, George Wallace and Richard Nixon days. And it's shown that, well, there has been advances in some places. There are some places where that is not even on the radar, right? And I think that that is a very hard lesson for those of us who are, throw it into the kind of progressive camp or whatever you want to say, to accept. And I think it's necessary to accept that at this point and not necessarily just be pissed off about it or think that it's terribly backwards or all of the things that I do think, but I can't stay there, right? And you go, okay, this is a real thing, and there's no fix that's going to be comfortable coming. And so that is my magical suggestion to people, is understand that what is visible now, even if it ceases to be as visible, isn't going away anytime soon. And so there's work to be done on that side. For me, it shut down a lot of stuff. I canceled, we live out in the country, so we do use Amazon Prime for shipping stuff to us. So that is the only streaming thing we have left. We turned them all off. We are not watching television at all. I haven't watched a movie or anything in months, and it's very few. And it's kind of sent me back into books. Like, I need a kind of quiet because of what's going on. it's got me really thinking about those issues magically again. And it's kind of why Weaving Fate came out, is I could kind of see where things were going. This is not like I'm the most precog guy in the world, but this is what's going on now politically is not a surprise. And I assumed I would see it in my lifetime. And so part of the Weaving Fate piece comes to that, that there is a thing that, as we said, there's earlier you mentioned, like there's a black and white in certain spell working and not working. We're in a world that is consistently trying to black and white mm-hmm. the social and political aspects, and that will not work.
Yeah.
And this is hard for people to take because the divisions are so clear. Right. There are, to most of us, I think, that are listening to you and I talk, they are crystal clear. Right. There is something that is like so fucking obvious. But that's not shared by everyone. And we have to accept that. And the only way that that changes, in my mind, is through really finding ways to radically change the narrative. Because if everybody is just knee-jerking back and forth at each other, you just have the kicking fight that we've got going on right now. And so I think for folks that are interested in seeing serious change to all of this stuff, it's time to get very subtle and not play those games. It's not to say you can always avoid those games. Things will happen that you need to stand up for. Absolutely. I'm not saying that that doesn't happen. But we really need to look at our own thinking about it and accept that we are in essentially, we're trying to live at least two different worlds, particularly in the United States as a people.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't fit together well.
No.
And they're not split along the lines. There's a view of clarity of the split that is not correct in my mind. So it's, again, if you look at the vast majority of states that vote red or vote blue, that's not really what's happening. That's what the Electoral College is doing. If you look at the people in those places. So we came, before we moved here, we were in deep, deep, deep rural Tennessee. And it was probably pretty evenly split between progressives and conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
The conservative side consistently won in the election processes because they're better at that game.
Oh, yeah.
And the game has been successfully rigged by them for a very long time to make sure that they get control of certain offices. The response I think that people want to have and that I want to have is that I also want to kick, right?
Mm.
I want to go, that's fucking absurd. It's ridiculous. And basically start talking shit. But this doesn't get us where we want to go, right? And so to me, the beauty of kind of the hyper-sigil process beyond the personal, if there is such a thing as beyond the personal, is I think it's really important to envision clearly what the other side of this looks like. And then do both the magical and the mundane work to get there. But if you're just stuck up in the fight, you can't get to the other side of the fight because the fight's not going to stop. So it really is like, it's almost, can you switch from, okay, I've got a, I think it's in Germania by Tacitus that he discusses this, but it's in one of those old Roman guys talking about the legions. And I've brought this up a lot because it's kind of an important concept to me personally. It has been in my life. Is he basically, in two different sections of this, he says, you know, we basically went into the Celtic countries and these people are the most hot-blooded people you could ever find. And so you wander in with a legion and you just start yelling, you know, fuck your mother. And the six guys that hear you will come and attack the legion and you kill them. And you just take over the entire country this way because there is no part of them that cannot engage.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I see going on politically, right? And then when they talk about rolling through some of the northern parts of that world, those people didn't care. And so they would roll in and they go, well, we found a bunch of farms and they were empty. And everything that could be harvested was harvested, and everything that couldn't be harvested was destroyed, so we couldn't have it. So we burned down their houses, but there was no one to fight, right? This isn't saying that this is the technique that needs to be done right now, but there's an intelligence here that somebody said, these guys can't hang out here. They're not going to stay the winter, right? So we can either fight them right now at our house and try and protect our house and die, or we can be very smart. And it's not about the choice that they made, but it's about the intelligence behind it. And I think as kind of magical practitioners in particular, how intelligent can you focus your work on the changes that you want to see? Not how do you respond to the current insult necessarily, but what is that world that you want on the other side of this? And what in you has to change? And what in the legal system has to change? And what in the economic system has to change? And can you get comfortable with what that does to you? Because it does something to you if, like you and I are, we are white males, right? Mm-hmm. Part of that does mean the thing that everybody is freaked out about. It means that you don't get the same level of privilege that you've always had. Whether you wanted it or not, whether you abused it or not, I know that my interaction with the law is different because of who I am on the surface. And so you have to really dig into that stuff and go, am I comfortable being on totally even ground? Because I think this is a subtext that people miss. Do I really want to see a culture where I don't have a leg up, right? It sounds good. And so we have to kind of find all those places inside of us, I think, as magicians that are uncomfortable with those things, and to look at it and to expose those things and go, okay, I would like to see that change. I would like to see a world that I'm more comfortable being in that doesn't hurt me to see what goes on. But what does that look like, really, for everybody? And am I willing to do work in that direction for everybody? Understanding that there's going to be mass resistance from people that have asked those same questions and said, no, I'm not down. I do want what I have at the expense of other people. People have been making that choice forever, right?
I could listen to your voice all day. And now I get to. Because you have a new podcast out. Well, welcome, first of all, to the Pagan Podkin.
Thank you.
You will become rich now. We're all very wealthy.
I understand that that's what happens next.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a welcome basket, and it has just buckets of money in it. Just lots of money. They don't tell you that it's that flash paper money. so don't get it near heat, because it will explode.
It's ghost money.
It is ghost money. It is the month. It's Hungry Ghost Month.
Hungry Ghost Month. We feed it to the ghosts.
Tell us about Six Ways the Podcast.
Sure. So I have had a Facebook group since either right before Six Ways came out or shortly thereafter. And at some point I began recording these incredibly rough videos. Mostly as question and answer things, or if I had a particular skill that I wanted to share that I could teach that way. And at some point I stopped because I really didn't like the fact that it was closed in behind the Facebook wall, because there are a million great reasons not to be on Facebook. And I totally accept that.
I love that so many people are like jumping ship this year. Every day I get closer to that delete account.
And so for me, I wanted to begin the process of setting myself up to be able to comfortably divest at some point. And I still wanted to be able to have interaction with people and answer questions and do things like that. And so the Six Ways podcast is really intended as a way to do that. Mm-hmm. That is independent of all platforms. It's on my own thing. Nobody gets to play with anybody's data. Nobody gets to spam anybody with anything unless you choose to go through, you know, Spotify to listen to it or something and don't have a premium account. And yeah, so it was just really, how do I get something that the folks that are on Facebook, that are on Instagram, that are not on any social media, can access that information. And so that's really what it was created for.
I love it. I'm so excited. You have one episode out now.
I do. The next one's coming shortly.
How often are you putting these babies? Are you doing what I used to do? And it was like, well, when I have something to say, I'll record. And when I don't have something to say, I won't record. So you might get three episodes from me in a week, and then you might get nothing from me for like 4 months.
That is probably the case. Yeah. I certainly am not on a schedule for it. I have a backlog of questions, and I'm also, I do take the fact that anybody would care to hear what I have to say really seriously. And so some of it is kind of, I get the questions, I kind of set up my bullet points that I want to hit in the thing. And then I sit back and go, okay, what do I think about this next week? And it's not that I'm concerned overly about being right, but I don't want to be throwing out shit that is not useful. That's not of interest to me. And so we'll see. The next one should be up shortly, but I've got 25 little slots of notes in Bear setup. So I'm set for a while and questions keep coming in. So we'll begin addressing them. And
That's so exciting. How are your other enterprises going? How's the jewelry?
I ceased making jewelry at the end of last year.
I know.
And will not be returning to it is the plan. So it's going great.
I stopped and I have continued to stop, and therefore the plan is going perfectly.
Exactly.
I am not doing it. I think exactly. I just asked because I was just secretly kind of curious.
No, that was, yeah, it was time for that to be done. It's going good. I will be working on getting the ebook of Six Ways done is the next project. And then I have got two books that are in process, and I have to pick which one is next. And those are more difficult projects than the first two. So we're going to see how that goes.
Any teasers? Do I get to know anything? Is there a title?
Yeah. The first one's working title.
Shirtless Selfies and How They...
is called The Small Buck.
Oh, that's not about shirtless selfies.
The Galder Buck and Small. But it's not going to be small, so I'm going to have to change it. and that one is a compendium of kind of essays and practices that don't really fit in the grander scheme of a single focus book. Also some stuff that is like tied into that thing I was talking about before. Like, okay, let's look at this. And if this works, which you should try and see, what does it mean about the rest of your practice? Do you think you're thinking clearly and in the way you want to be thinking? Because that's really the more important one. About what you do. So that one I'm very excited for. And then there is a really kind of hellishly tricky one to figure out how to make it work properly, which is tentatively called A Book of Sigils. That is both my thinking about the process of sigils and how I do sigil work. And again, since this is going to be a recurring theme forever, what does it mean that sigil magic works some of the time? And then kind of the grimoire component, which is these are sigils I've been using for a very, very long time and that I share with people. And some of my talismanic work falls into that. The jewelry work falls into that category. And again, like looking at, here's a toolkit that the intention there is, again, more to expose my thinking behind them than, yes, you can use it as a toolkit, but it's also, why did I think this was something that one might use? Because again, I think that that's the piece that's very helpful from that kind of 201 perspective.
Well, all of that sounds incredibly exciting. I don't know which I want to come out first. I just want it all. I want my own little Aidan Wachter bookshelf and just filled with little green spines.
Yep.
I can't wait. Well, congratulations on all of your success, Aidan. I am so excited for you. I'm so excited that the work that you're doing is being received so well, so widely. People love your work. People have always loved your work, so it's not surprising. If folks want to find more about you, get access to your podcast, where do they go to do that?
Everything is at AidanWachter.com, and there are links at the bottom of the page out to all my social media. So.
Well, thank you so much, Aidan. Thanks for being here on The Riot. I appreciate it so much, and good luck in all of your future endeavors, sir.
Thank you for having me again. It was great.
I want to thank my guest, Aidan Wachter, for being here today, for talking about his new book, Weaving Fate, Hypersigils, Changing the Past and Telling True Lies. It came out in August this year, and it is already just tearing up the charts. Please go get it wherever fine books are sold. If you can get it from your local witchy shop, great. I know that right now access is limited for a lot of people, so get it however you can. Just get it, because it is completely worth it. Once again, little plug, remember that Patreon supporters heard this episode first. You get cool perks in this time of COVID. There's not quite as many perks as I was hoping for, there are some cool perks. I did add a perk this past month, so for all Patreon supporters at all levels, we now have a private Discord server, and that's been really cool to start to get to know you guys in a more informal setting. I know that I've had social media for a very long time, getting to sort of get into the weeds and talk some nitty gritty stuff about episodes and just what your day looks like and rituals and spells and suggestions and stuff like that. That's a cool thing to get to do. So if you would like to join the Discord server, you can join. Join the Patreon at any level, and you get access to the Discord server. So in addition to full audio, full video, early access to episodes, hints about upcoming content, occasional freebies, and that kind of stuff, you also get to join the Discord server. This has been a super long episode, so I'm not going to keep you very long. Remember that you can keep up with me. I'm at Inciting a Riot on pretty much all major forms of social media. I neither tick nor talk, nor do I snap or chat, but you can find me Firelight on Facebook. The show is, of course, Inciting a Riot Podcast on Facebook. Instagram and Twitter are at Inciting a Riot. Please feel free to follow me on there. I did my first, it wasn't a TikTok, it was a Reel, which is the Instagram version of TikTok. I did my first one of those, and that went mini viral. It said a few thousand views, so that was kind of fun. So I did that. So if you do Instagram, you can find me at Inciting a Riot, and we were talking what books of shadows look like and the different kinds of books of shadows that I've owned, from like a big giant leather bound tome to a USB flash drive or a notes app or something. So you can come join the conversation on there, or of course around most other forms of social media. One last plug, we are starting to come up to the point where if you would like to join the Samhain Show, if you are a musician, if you're a poet, if you make cool spells, if you're some type of creative artist that can translate that into sound of some kind, I am putting together this year's Samhain Show. The last several years, you guys have really shown up with some great content, original stories, poems, that kind of thing. So if you are a creator, please get in touch. Firelight, F-I-R-E-L-Y-T-E, at incitingariot.com. You can email me, just put the subject line, Samhain Show, or Hello Riot, or Hey Me Me Me. and I will see that, and we can talk about permissions and stuff and putting your work on the show. All that said, I'm going to leave you. I hope that you guys are safe. Today, September 22nd here in the United States, is like National Make Sure You're Registered to Vote Day. So make sure that you're registered to vote. There's a lot of places that you can do that kind of thing. I think like vote.org is one of them. So go to vote.org. but just make sure that you're registered to vote. This election is it's probably the most important election that I'm ever going to see in my lifetime. So please, please, please think of the most marginalized person that you know and vote in that person's best interests. Make a plan to vote if you don't already have one. Mail in a ballot if you can. Put it into a ballot drop box if you can. If you feel like showing up at the polls, please make sure that you're taking safety precautions before you do so. Pack a lunch. I hear the lines are going to be very, very long. I think I heard a news story that there were, for early voting in Virginia, there were already like 4 hour long waits to do that. So that was pretty incredible. I might be wrong. I don't have that link up. So you can feel free to fact check me. I know y'all love doing that. I'm going to leave you. But as always, I will leave you with love and light, firelight.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.